supposed to be Saturday?
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falkenstein from Falcon Screen, and we are joined by freelance writer and critic Virat Nehru.
Hello, people.
And Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
Hello, hello.
Now, we will be talking later in the program about Rocket Man, the Elton John biopic, which has its Australian opening tomorrow, as well as... there's a lot to break down here.
Yes,
it had its premiere at the State Theatre on Saturday night, and it will be available everywhere in cinemas everywhere.
You were there, in the front row, as I imagine.
Pretty much, yeah. I've been waiting for this my entire life. And we will also be talking about Agrabah and Ababwa.
Aladdin,
which is in cinemas now. But first, it is Sydney Film Festival. It is the biggest film event of the year. It kicks off...
In Sydney, for sure. Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
No, come on. The world. Yeah. Sydney is the center of the universe. We are the oysters of the world, you know, the pearls of the oysters and whatever that means.
Is there a world outside Sydney? I don't know. I've been in the studio so long.
All I know is the movies, and Sydney Film Festival gives me plenty of those.
It will be in cinemas, in event cinemas, George Street, State Theatre, everywhere from the 5th to the 16th of June, 1 week today.
Forgotten the scary Dendy Opera.
And the Opera Keys and Dendy Newtown, plus Gazula Powerhouse and a few more.
Made at Cremon Orpheum.
And the Cremon Orpheum. But we are talking this week about the documentaries that are screening at the Sydney Film Festival. And we have the documentary programmer for SFF, Jenny Neighbour, here with us on the show. Jenny, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So we want to talk about the vast array of documentaries that you have screening at the festival. First, a more broad question. You're the programmer. What went to the creative direction and decisions broadly into selecting films for this year's program?
It basically boils down to what's out there. What are you interested in? What do we think our audience are interested in? What's going to be ready in time for us? So you look at what's in production. And then you kind of almost try and create a feast, you know, and a feast being something that you might want to eat, but you also know your friends might want to come and eat and join you. And so you've got a complexity of flavors and topics and subjects and languages. And then it all comes together. And you try and create that balance. I think it's really important. And I think that's what Sydneysiders seem to like, to be able to have a taste of everything that's out there in the documentary world.
I'm just curious, does Sydney Film Festival receive a lot more documentary submissions than it does feature submissions?
Yes, I would say so.
Yeah, because it really seems like we're in a golden age for documentaries right now.
You know, I think people have been saying that for about 15 years.
Right.
Because documentary is just, at festivals all around the world, become stronger and stronger. And while maybe not at the box office with all the streaming services now, there's a lot more complexity and depth around what's available in the documentary world.
And the tools required to make a documentary are cheaper than ever.
Absolutely, and lighter as well. Mm.
Absolutely. I was thinking of the political documentaries, and there are many, 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 many of them, but the one that is front and center of mind is Reason, which I'm just thinking of because India just had its elections, and it's talking about some really, really interesting things in what is the Hindu right-wing fascism, and it's quite brave, it's quite confronting, and what can people expect from it?
4 hours, right?
That is true.
It's 4 hours, but it's an incredibly deep and elaborate story. I mean, it follows the whole kind of shift of between faith and reason and the divisions that create in the community. And also poverty comes into it, the way the wealthy in India kind of own many of the electoral seats, and all of that detail. And Anand Patwardhan, the filmmaker, he won the award in Amsterdam for this film, and he's renowned for kind of trying to put these really complex ideas into these extraordinary essay films. It's not doubtful it's ever going to be shown in India, and it's one that probably will never appear on your TV screens. Just the length would be a bar for that, I guess. So one to really see at the cinema, I think.
Talking about political documentaries, did you notice any strong trends in the films that were submitted and that you selected?
I think there's very much a sense that the personal is political. So there are stories like, for instance, The Edge of Democracy. The filmmaker Petra Costa, she's basically the same age as democracy in Brazil. But her parents were, you know, fought for democracy. And she comes of age as democracy arrives, But in that arc of her telling that story, corruption, prosecution, and the end of this, the decline of democracy happens. So it becomes a very personal story. It's shaped her life. It's shaped her family's life. And I think that's very common in a lot of the films that are around at the moment, how politics shapes your life.
Mm-hmm. I'm most regretful on the level that there are so many Brazilian films playing at the festival. I caught a preview of one today, which is screening an opening night, Divine Love, and Osa Marighella, which is one of the main stays of the festival.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen Marighella, I have to say. Desperate to see it because I'm a big fan of Vargas Mouros, the filmmaker. And he's also an actor. He was in Elite Squad a few years back, but he's also was Escobar in Narcos. And he's going to be at the festival. So yes. It's going to be fascinating to hear him talk about his first feature film, his first as a director.
Now, changing tack just a little bit, one I'm quite keen to catch, I think it's the only film I've ever seen at Sydney Film Festival which has a question mark in the title.
Yeah.
Now, this group was actually going to be on my radar for a bit because I watch Riverdale and Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and they are in quite some trouble with the organisation, which is front and centre in this movie.
So, yes, Hail Satan with the question mark. And it's really surprising because it's such an extraordinary story of a group that's basically fighting for their right to support Satan, who they believe in, and how the American system is like, well, there's rights for everybody else, so maybe there should be rights for you. But of course, the climate they're fighting in is not one that's very, doesn't come down on their side, I think you could say. And it's made by Penny Lane, and she's a really interesting filmmaker who looks at these various groups and different voices in the US.
Hmm. I was curious about the Untitled Amazing Jonathan documentary, which has a very confusing description in the guide. It sounds like it could be something like Exit Through the Gift Shop, a film that's in the sense that it's could be playing a prank on the audience, but I haven't seen it, so.
I think that it is confusing to describe because a lot of it is about filmmaking itself, because the director of the film decided to make a documentary about a magician, the amazing Jonathan, who had been told that he only had a few months to live, but 3 years later, he's still alive. So this filmmaker, who's a young filmmaker, says, I'm going to make a film about him, gets permission to do so. And within a short space of time, discovers there are several other people making a documentary about him as well. And they all keep getting in each other's ways. So he begins to doubt his subject. He begins to doubt what the subject of his documentary is telling him, whether it's all trickster, whether it's, you know, the magician is telling him lies, basically. And so it becomes very much a story about filmmaking and what do you believe and why do you think that is true? And also at the same time, a film about this trickstery kind of guy who is taking this bunch of filmmakers on a journey as well.
Right.
It's inevitably very funny in the process. Yeah.
Reminds me of a film from last year called Mes Ampour, which did the same thing about doubting its subject kind of thing. So it's fascinating. Now I'm drawn towards festival favorite Frederick Wiseman with Monrovia, Indiana, which apart from the actual film itself, which is fascinating, the one thing that strikes me is how cleanly it's shot. I mean, there's something about how Wiseman frames its subjects, which I feel a lot of filmmakers can learn from, because the camera work is astounding, and it is very old school, but also fresh, because I feel filmmakers complicate things too much these days.
He gives his characters a lot of space, and you really get the sense of them living in that community. It's set in that Midwest town, and there's the plains around it. There's the kind of agricultural work that goes on, the streets, the shop fronts. You really get a sense of place, and you don't feel crammed into rooms where someone's being interviewed. He's always called the ultimate fly on the wall filmmaker. And he always argues with that because he says a fly on the wall has no intervention. And he does have intervention. He totally picks his moments and his subjects. But for me, this one also, because he's now in his late 80s, if not 89, 90, I think, there's a sequence in this film which talks about death. It has a funeral. and it has this ceremony. And there's a lot of moments in the film that are about ceremony, about the kind of ceremonies and the processes that we go through. And it's almost like he's reflecting on that end of life as well. Did you feel that when you saw it?
Yeah, I did. And also it's sad because not only from a, I think, personal point of view, but also the people who've been left behind almost, and they feel that they're at the end of their kind of life that they knew it. So it is metaphorical in that sense as well. But also just fascinating to see how someone could put something so personal in a story which has nothing to do about them. But yet, I guess Herzog does it with Meeting Gorbachev as well.
Yes,
so I think
he does.
Both the masters are kind of back to form.
And you can certainly tell Herzog is like, he just adores Gorbachev. And there's
which is very scary to digest for me personally. But you got to admit, he's very, yeah, very convincing.
On the subject of masters and passing, we have the final film by Agnes Varda in the documentary section this year, Varda by Agnes. I'm a huge fan of Agnes Varda, so yeah, the trailer made me think this is going to be a tough watch in some ways. I mean, her films, and outside of Vagabond, I would never describe her films as a tough watch, yeah. But I mean, only in the sense that I felt tremendous sadness watching to know that she's gone, I guess.
Tremendous, the trailer. Yes, sadness that she's gone, but the film is very funny. Mm. She's always such a mischievous filmmaker. She plays tricks both visually and in time. And so when you're watching, you're just reminded of what a talent she is, how much she enjoyed life, how much her films kind of show that joy in life. And so it's not actually sad. It's a celebration. I came away feeling like I've got to go and see all her other films again. This is a filmmaker who is there's no one like her. And I actually saw the film when it premiered at Berlin, at the film festival in Berlin, when she was there and she was introduced beforehand, and she was very frail, and she came up on stage and gave the most remarkable speech, not one of those kind of long and boring ones, but one that was full of the pleasure of cinema and all that her life has been evolved. And I think that's the spirit of the film. So no, you don't need tissues at all for this one.
Another film I'm very keen to talk about, one I caught very recently, was one about a book, a childhood book I still have in my cupboard that I think many people have read all around the world. And what struck me about this, among other things, was some of the best cinematography I've seen in any film this year.
Me and Glenn watched this one together. The Miracle of the Little Prince.
It's a totally delightful story, and I think, and we had very exciting news this week that the Sami woman who features in the film is going to be in Sydney.
Oh, really?
That's wonderful.
That's great.
And her story is extraordinary, but going to the Sami community, were often not allowed to use their own language. They were bullied, and she finds comfort in reading The Little Prince, and then later becomes a translator and translates it into Sami. And so this idea that different communities can take different things from that book. And I'm so looking forward to meeting her.
I am too. I would love to meet her. I spent some time over January in the Australia Day weekend in northern Finland and Sweden, and I met actually a number of members of the Sami Youth Parliament, and they were telling me about this, that they hadn't had an opportunity to learn the language in schools, speak it openly, and the fact there is this outlet and those avenues are increasing in some respects is really, really good. And I'm so glad that she will be here.
Yes. And I think also what's interesting in that film is the very trade, if you like, of translation, that the two Chinese interpreters who kind of both take different tangents on sentences. And we don't think about that sometimes when we see subtitled films, the slight nuance, the difference that can make. It's a remarkable film.
I think often the subtitles we get are quite poorly translated, unfortunately. So
I think it varies country to country, to be honest. Mm. Some are much better at doing it than others.
Right.
Yeah.
Another film that looked to be really beautifully shot was Up the Mountain. I watched the first few minutes of this one and then thought, oh, I'll get to it later because I was not awake enough. But I did not realize it was a documentary. It looks like it's this exquisitely beautifully framed
It's framed to match the paintings that are featured in the film. And it feels like a real community in transition, like an artist living in this valley in China, or a mountain valley in China. And he has this group of the most delightful women who paint folk art, and they come to his studio and they chatter away, and then they go down to the village and down to the lakeshore, which is rapidly changing. It's becoming, like much of China, it's changing, population growing, but there's also tourism involved. And you get this extraordinary sense of a community in transition. And that's very true of the Chinese documentaries in the festival this year, like One Child Nation and Leftover Women, this kind of shift that's going on in the community there.
Mm. Yeah, we caught Leftover Women. It's quite a confronting one.
Yes, yes. There's some scenes there that, as a woman, makes you definitely want to stamp your feet and yell at the screen.
Yes.
Indeed.
Talking about transitions and the shift in communities, The Brink featuring Steve Bannon was something that I wanted to hate, but I couldn't, and I was very surprised by my reaction to it.
I'm thinking, don't shoot the messenger here. We all want to hate Steve Bannon.
I know. No, but I'm not saying that I still don't hate Steve Bannon, but I'm still saying the subject of Steve Bannon in the documentary was something I didn't hate.
I think it's a remarkable piece of filmmaking. Alison Clayman is just kind of gets under his skin, and she's like this really quiet presence, and you feel that you really feel that he's trying to play it, like he's trying to play up to her, he's trying to wind her up, but she never responds, and she's just this figure who's just taking it all in and revealing him in the process. It's a really clever work.
And just the resilience that it takes from a filmmaker's point of view to actually, you know, engage with your subject or not engage sometimes, and how can you actually tell stories and in that sense, it's actually a quite confrontational and hostile environment in that sense. So it was fascinating to know that.
And additionally, we've been asking what we're very keen to see or what have seen. Is there one that has struck you, or that we haven't mentioned, that you think might fly under the radar, or that audiences should seek out?
Yeah, what would you like to recommend?
What would I like to recommend? Well, there's a couple. We were talking about China. There's another film called American Factory, which is actually an American film, but it's about a Chinese company that goes to open a factory in China, making parts for cars. And it is a total culture clash, which sometimes is very funny, sometimes is quite shocking. But really, we were talking about the personal being political. The people in this town in the US desperately want work. The Chinese managers who come in desperately want to make it work. But there is such a difference in their approach to work, to your colleagues at work, to the hours you work, that it just keeps failing on every level. So while it's very funny, it's also really fascinating. And there's one other, which on another political one, on the inside of a military dictatorship, which is about the transition to democracy in Myanmar, and how it's never really, it just hasn't ever had democracy. So how is a country that's not had that experience, how do they actually make that change? How do they put those values in their thinking? It's quite a fascinating film. And interviews with all sorts of ex-military leaders that really puts the history in really great context.
So we've spoken a lot about the films, but we want to know how to get there. So people who want to buy tickets, where do we go?
So you go to the Sydney Film Festival website, sff.org.au, and just choose your films and click where you can.
Wonderful. Jenny, we are looking forward to the festival, and it's only a week away, so book, because films are already selling out. Yeah. Many have sold out.
Sales are a lot faster than last year, so I would say now is the time to look at that program and get on.
Ex Libris, I think last year was the first film to sell out, I think within like the first hours or so, which was surprising.
I'm sure Apollo 11 will sell out pretty quickly.
I think the first one to sell out this year, another documentary, was the Miles Davis one.
Yes. Oh yes, Birth of Cool.
I think there might just be one or two tickets left, but it's great. It's got the best archive footage. Then following very closely, I think, by the Marianne and Leonard, the one about Leonard Cohen and his muse.
Yes,
Rolling Thunder one will have to do well, the Martin Scorsese documentary on Bob
There's
Dylan.
So many music documentaries this year.
Ah, don't miss the reggae one as well. Personal favourite, the reggae one. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, yep. Absolutely.
Cool.
Well, I think the next one we're catching is Pole 11, but we will be catching a few of the music ones at the festival. Jenny, thank you so much. And we'll be back right after this, talking Rocket Man and, oh my God, Agrabah, Aladdin. Stay tuned.
Saturdays from 8 p.m. for Keeping Score. My name is Leah, and each week we'll unravel the soundtracks and musical scores from some of our favourite movies. The soundtrack to your Saturday night. Keeping Score on 2SCR 107.3.
Welcome back to Film Fight Club. So we are talking all things movies. We just had the City Film Festival, and now we are into, well, Rocket Man. Oh my God, you thought it was going to be a long, long time, but we are here now.
I'm going to avoid all your supposed Elton John references.
I'm not going
to acknowledge any of them.
There are just so many. I was the young man in the 22nd row at the premiere on Saturday night. I could go on for a long time. And the reason for this is, and this is the one time I have real trouble assessing this film objectively in many senses, because I'm a bigger Elton John fan than I'm a movie fan. I was at Elton John concerts on my 8th.
I think everyone knows. Everyone who's ever listened to even 1 second of the show knows that.
Yeah, fair call. Actually, it was just coincidental. We were in Kingsman and thought, wow, Elton just wrote us a theme track. So I went into this. I've been waiting for a movie about Elton John my entire life. It is directed by Dexter Fletcher, who was credited with Bohemian Rhapsody, and starring Taron Egerton as Elton John.
Not at the Oscars.
Not at the Oscars, no.
Where it has no director.
No. Oh, dear. Jamie Bell as Bernie Taupin, Richard Madden, and a number of other... Bryce Dallas Howard is in it. There's a decent cast. This is a music biopic, a standard one in many respects, that follows Elton from his earliest days as a child and as a child piano prodigy to the early 80s era of Elton John. Now...
Is it good?
All right. There's a lot... Distinguish the style of this film. This is something between Jersey Boys and Mamma Mia. Sometimes music in the background, sometimes music is incidental, like when Elton is nutting out Your Song on the piano. Other times it's fully fledged Mamma Mia style explosions of music. Egerton, first of all, is outstanding. He looks the part. No, he's not as good a singer as Elton John, who is, but he can measure up in so many respects. He's about as good as you can expect. He, according to his statement at the premiere, everything you hear is him. The only song he sang live was Your Song, which he was nutting out on the piano quite early in the film. So a lot of it is dubbed, but it is all him, according to Egerton.
Well, it is called Your Song, so I get it. I mean, it doesn't, you know.
It would be pretty unfair if it was someone else. Look, this, in terms of the musical numbers, it hits about half the time. I Want Love, which is very early in the piece, which is the only late era Elton John song. It's 18 years after the second latest piece. It was the best of the show. Honky Cat with Richard Madden was excellent. Crocodile Rock was good. There's a scene where they all lift off the ground, and it's like you're at an Elton John concert. You can feel it. Good Burial Big Road. God, Pinball Wizard.
Yeah, but was it good?
Was it good? Okay.
All right. We don't want the best of Elton John album songs. But this is we want the movie.
All right. Good. Picking up on that, that's what this is. This is one of the problems with this film that Bohemian Rhapsody had too. There is one song in this film, Border Song is the exception, where it is not on the greatest hits volume. This is an Elton John greatest hits concert, which is only good if you like Elton John. I love Elton John. I'll be seeing this film a lot for years to come. If you're not an Elton John fan, frankly, there is not a lot in the retelling to recommend it. Most of the other numbers are Shoehorn, Tiny Dancer, The Bitch is Back. It's kind of like the song Lily James did at the beginning of Mamma Mia 2, Kiss the Teacher. It makes no sense in the context of the musical.
Oh, that's like every song Lily James did, except probably,
Mamma Mia was great, dude.
Okay. All right, cool. Okay. We'll fight about that another day.
In terms of the storytelling, it's not quite on Bohemian Rhapsody level bad, but there's a lot of bad things about it. The cliche, don't watch this film right after you watch Walk Hard, trust me. The entire story is framed as Elton John recounting his narrative while he is undergoing rehab. It starts in his childhood, just like every other music biopic. No, this is not a bad thing, and yes, it's an interesting era of Elton's life, it's just that we've seen it done time and time again.
Okay, I'm going to raise my hand and say something very stupid. I know nothing about Elton John's younger life and anything else, so is that going to be influential, and would I learn anything exceptional if I were to watch this movie, if I know nothing about Elton John's life?
I hope so. God damn, if we don't.
You don't actually learn too much about his early life, honestly.
Okay, that's even fatter. I thought at least if I knew nothing, that I could go in and come out with a renewed appreciation of like, oh my God, now I know about Elton John.
Look, the most interesting era about Elton John is his late era post-1999 stuff, but the early Elton stuff, like mid-70s through to the 80s, it's really good, and that's the era they cover. However, they cover everything. They sandwich everything in. His marriage was covered in two scenes. They try to cover his entire life, a la Bohemian Rhapsody, and it's just way too much for a film. And on top of that, you have to hit all the beats, winning over cynical record producer. They name check everyone from Dylan to Leon Russell. Lots of big montages going through years of signs. And remember the manager, Peter Baelish in Bohemian Rhapsody? Richard Madden, Rob Stark, plays the exact same role in this movie. It's very, very frustrating to see. So there's some great sequences. The Pinball Wizard sequence where the pace of the song is matched by the graphics and the effects, the amazing recreation of one of Elton's most famous video clips. And there is the worst sequence in the film is actually the titular sequence where they recreate Rocket Man. It's very badly done. It's very over the top, and they deal with a very serious issue in a very confronting issue in a not a serious way, and don't follow through on the effects and ramifications of it. So that was the worst aspect of the film. Okay. But there's a lot to recommend it, though I think only enough to recommend it for casual to serious Elton John fans.
Okay. Yeah. I can live with that. Okay.
So that was not Bohemian Rhapsody. That was Walk Hard: The Elton John Story. No, that was Rocket
Man. Biggest question is it going to win Taron Egerton his Oscar?
He'll get nominated. I don't think he'll win.
You think he'll get nominated?
I think he's very good, and he looks the part. He obviously throws himself into it. Even the lousier numbers. I didn't mention Saturday Night's Alright for Fighting. It makes no sense in the context of the musical, but just how energetic he is, he makes it good. And the staging makes it
good.
This
movie
sounds
so literal in how it uses the music.
There's a sequence where, the Rocket Man, forgoing the actual meaning of the song, in the beginning of any of the songs, really, they show him shooting off into the, well, they take it extremely literally. And they missed out on songs that were much more consequential. Someone Saved My Life Tonight, Empty Sky, Madman Across the Water, Tumbleweed Connection, and all the great later era Elton John stuff. It's just not there. So there's good things, but if you're a casual Elton John fan, see it. If you're not, maybe pick up one of his albums and have a listen.
So maybe it's important that we actually, you know, actors now pick deliberately bad films and give standout performances, because then it's easier to win an Oscar.
Like Rami Malek.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Rami Malek?
He was actually not good in Bohemian Rhapsody at all.
Taron Egerton was better cast.
Right. Okay.
Much better cast.
Well, he's pale and whiter, so I guess, yeah.
Is he?
I think so.
I don't think so at all. So that is Rocket Man. It's in cinemas tomorrow. The other film we're talking about the last few minutes and continuing on the podcast is Aladdin, the remake. Just quickly, because we only have a couple of minutes, what did we all think of Aladdin?
I'll expand on this, but it was really strange.
Maybe it was low expectations, but I enjoyed a lot of it.
I strangely did too. I wouldn't recommend it, but
I would for just a casual watch or a date movie.
Yeah.
Unless my date would come to an end right there and right that moment, which has happened sometimes when I pick bad movies, because I have a history of picking bad date movies. I think
if you're right, takes his dates to see Reason, let's go and see a 4-hour film about.
Actually, did take someone to see Cold War, and that was not a good idea.
No, there's an
okay. Cool.
So it's dating advice from Film Fight Club.
Yeah.
Anyway, suffice to say, we're not together.
but Aladdin.
Back to Aladdin. Look, I do agree with you guys. It is fun, but I think we are now just so desperate for just a little bit of fun that our expectations are so low, the bar is so low, that Aladdin doesn't really have to do much, which is the sad bit. You know, this is not fun because, oh my God, it's a breath of fresh air, and it is fun. It's like, oh my God, at least it tried, so it's fun. You know, which is not what...
Expectations have lowered dramatically in the recent dark years of blockbuster corporate filmmaking.
It's due to Solo. The expectations are so low due to Solo. So that is Aladdin. We'll be talking much more detail about it on the podcast, which you can subscribe to on iTunes and Spotify. We will be back next week talking with City Film Festival director Nashan Moodley about any late editions that may or may not happen and the City Film Festival program. City Film Festival kicks off from the 16th of June.
There always are.
And that Rocket Man is in cinemas tomorrow. Aladdin is in cinemas now.
Hold off on fixing that program too much. Leave some space open.
This has been Glenn Fowlings and Chris Evans of Arat Nehru. Join us soon for more City Film Festival coverage. Have a wonderful night. Enjoy movies. Good night.
Streets, open sesame. Here we go! Arabian Nights, like Arabian Days. They tease and excite, take off and take flight. They shock and amaze.
Arabian Nights. Thank you for suggesting that, Farad. I have not heard that since 3:30... on school afternoons in my childhood home watching.
It was all about 9:30, like 8:30 on Saturday mornings. I'm pretty sure it was about that time that Aladdin would have played.
I always thought it was late afternoon. Disney. I remember it was definitely on Saturday Disney. But now I'm confused. That show was great. I actually preferred it to the Aladdin movies.
It was on Saturday Disney.
It's actually one of those things where maybe it was great, but I'm not going to revisit it and check.
No,
it lived fondly in my memories.
Because the band got together, Iago was the good guy now, and they were just wearing adventures to other lands.
And honestly, look, you guys saw the English version, but back in India, it was translated into Indian languages, which made it even funnier.
The TV show.
Oh, so it was like I had not heard the actual English version of this song for a long time. I have the Hindi version playing in my head, which is not as exciting, but still have the Robin Williams dub, which is
a nice
homage. But yeah,
so we're picking up on the new Aladdin film, which does not star Robin Williams, sadly. It does star a number of new actors, a number of established actors. We talked a little bit about how we feel about this film. I feel they blew it. It's actually not that bad. I mean, it's kind of like the election.
So you know, it's B-L-U-E.
Yes.
Yeah. Just spell it out.
You know, it's like in Batman singing that song in the animated Justice League version. Am I blue? You'd be too. And the tears in my eyes telling you.
Wait, Batman sings this
song? Kevin
Conroy.
Kevin Conroy sings it, and it's the only time they have it, and it's a fascinating clip of doing that in the animated Justice League.
Cool.
I would rather see an animated Justice League than the Justice League film. But anyway, Aladdin. So, look.
We try to avoid talking about Aladdin in so many ways.
Look, everyone went into this, us included, with really low expectations. And like the Liberal Party, this has really benefited from that because it's actually quite enjoyable in stretches. I was surprised because I've been a big fan of Guy Ritchie
like
for a number of years.
Like the Liberal Party, the only thing it exists for is money. No.
Well, they do have the color blue in common, so.
Yeah, true.
True.
Yeah, I hope that was intentional, Glenn, because otherwise your genius would be on another level.
My genius? Oh! No, but look, the best scenes Will Smith as the genie are when he's not blue, because it looks strange. The Friend Like Me sequence is terrible, except for the reprise at the end with DJ Khaled, which is the best scene in the film.
No, look, the Friend Like Me sequence, I was all right with, because it just epitomized the film. Like this film is this bizarre CGI fantasia, and this sequence was just all out digital nonsense.
You know the best scene in the film? It had almost nothing digital in it. They just sped up the action. It was the new sequence where they were dancing to music to no lyrics in the palace. They all had to do a bit of acrobatics to impress. The genie was trying to get him to impress the Princess Jasmine. That was really good. Again, the DJ Khaled bit at the end where they do the sped up version of Friend Like Me. Prince Ali was all right.
Okay, guys, you know what you're saying? You're saying the movie bits that actually were good were the new, the fresh bits.
Yes.
You know? The ones that were not trying to rope in the original. Sorry. That was the worst Freudian slip. Oh, God.
Raping the original? Is that what I just heard?
That's definitely
not what happened.
Okay, guys,
it's not that bad. It doesn't rape the original.
This film has a lot of good things going for it.
Rope,
The other new bit, though, I'm actually kind of split on. It was the Naomi Scott song because there was no Princess Jasmine number in the original.
Oh, geez.
The song
is
completely inconsistent with every other song.
Yeah,
it's not a bad song in and of itself. And she
maybe
is good.
Not.
Naomi Scott is a really good singer. She's a good actress.
Look, it sounds nothing like the rest of the songs in the soundtrack, so it just draws your attention to how the original was so backwards in terms of gender roles and that this has been pasted in. You know, the way that it just feels out of place.
I don't think we should criticize it by saying it's. I mean, yes, it is in respect tokenistic, but I still appreciated the song. It was a good song. It was an empowering song. I've been listening to it, the soundtrack separately, and I like it. I enjoyed it, and the reprise actually was much better than the original staging of the song. She only gets to sing a little bit at the beginning.
The staging of most of the original songs, actually all of the original songs, is derived from the way that they were staged in the original film, and as soon as Speechless comes on, you can tell they just have no idea how to put together a musical sequence. She just walks around singing. There's no striking visuals to go with it. There's no interesting choreography. She just walks around singing about how she wants to have
agency. Yeah. Well,
Disney brought female empowerment to the Kingdom of Agrabah.
But also, it's sad, right? That female empowerment is now reduced to a song. You know that.
But it's tokenistic.
It is tokenistic, but there's nothing beyond that song that kind of tells you otherwise.
I still appreciate that the song was there, and I appreciate it was a good song.
I know, but is that the bar? And once again, we're back to the bar. Is this the bar that we're going for? Is it like, it's not even a hurdle? It's more like a doorstop. You know, and it's like it's that.
Well, at least they added another female character in this film.
Female character. That's where we're at. At least we added in a female character.
The thing about
I know it's sad, but the Simpadrad was really good, and her scenes with the genie were the best in the film. They were pure gold.
This film is so weird. When I was watching it, it struck me that this is not like the kind of film that Disney would otherwise make, ever. Disney, you know, look at what else Disney or anyone else making Hollywood blockbusters make. Have you ever seen anything like this Aladdin in the last 20 years?
Beauty and the Beast.
That's also a Disney CGI. But these films only exist because they're, drive to make some money out of these.
Yeah,
beloved properties that are lying on the shelf. We haven't exploited them enough.
But it's more than nostalgia.
Money out of nostalgia.
But it's more than nostalgia.
But you end up...
It's the fact that this has a very defined audience. They waited decades for this audience to appear. It is the audience of people who were an adolescent or teenager at some point in the 90s who are now old enough to take their dates or their partners to see this movie, which it will definitely get that audience. Additionally, it's going to get the audience of parents who want to take their kids
to see
this movie.
It's
a safe Disney movie.
The point I'm trying to make is stylistically... Beauty and the Beast. Outside of Disney live action movies, it doesn't resemble, and this is the best thing about the film, it doesn't resemble anything that Hollywood would make.
And you know why? Because it's the most colorful film
I've
seen, and so
it's
visually
weird,
extravagant.
But it's kind of it is eye-popping, but I wouldn't say that the art direction is particularly good. It's so weird because it's locales that are clearly designed, and costumes as well, for an animated feature. And it's a structure of a plot. Everything about it screams, you know, early 90s animated feature. Or I should just say Aladdin because we're all familiar with that. But it's suddenly been transposed into live-action CGI blockbuster. So it feels completely fake. You know, like the... And sometimes I find this interesting. Like, the Friend Like Me thing was so garish and fake that I thought, okay.
No, that sequence was just, cool. I couldn't handle it. It was too visually. Again, I'll contrast it with the Pinball Wizard sequence in Rocket Man, which was very creative but still subdued. There was just too much going on in the frame. Too many genies, lamps, too much.
It's not as successful as it is in animation because the whole new world scene, when I watched that, I just thought, it's stirring because the song is good. But it's a terrible sequence. It looks like a bunch of just generic CGI locales.
A whole new world.
A whole new world. Yeah. In the cartoon, there's no
sense
issue
of wonder.
Magic. That's right. And there's no clash between the style that the people are drawing. There's no green screen issues. We've seen so much green screen crap that watching people fly through past like a CG waterfall and you know a CG village doesn't create wonder.
But the scene is worse than that in that it doesn't the chemistry doesn't work, and it doesn't work with the lyrics. During the sequence moment where he says that you dare close your eyes, she doesn't even bother to close her eyes. Like, there's no choreography. There's no choreography in terms of sorry, so they just relate the lyrics because they know that you're going to love this because it's a whole new world and you've seen it.
Actually,
and you have to love it because it's your favorite song from when you were 5 years old.
Actually, the street rat sequence was weirder. In animation, you can sell the audience on people singing as they, you know, jump and run and parkour around, and there's action and fighting going on. Seeing it happen in live action is kind of jarring because as I'm watching it, I'm thinking, like, shouldn't he be out of breath? It's just this strange cognitive dissonance. Doesn't translate.
Do you know what this is a lot like? This is like the 50s era Universal MGM pirate features before they went out of fashion. There's a Burt Lancaster film called The Crimson Pirate, which is very colorful and in terms of costume and design and set design, but it's very much, the appeal is the actors doing acrobatics and jumping around the set. And it's the same sort of thing. There was a really winceworthy sequence in this during that street rat sequence where the guard is running up after him. He just kind of dodges him slyly behind, running up a bit of staircase, and someone jumps in away. And there's a cartoonish element to it, which doesn't match. And we'll get more into this, which doesn't match with how the cartoonish elements render throughout the rest of the film. It worked in the 50s, the Burt Lancaster movie, because the entire film was like that. But then they try to do gritty, realistic action, and
Nothing about this is gritty or realistic.
But they aim for that with Jafar, which is the worst thing about the film, which we'll get to later. But I think the biggest issue with this movie is that they're trying to bring animation to life, and the human action, even with the sped up, it simply isn't fast, energetic, or kinetic enough to match what they're trying to do with the dance sequences or the music.
Talking about the dance sequences, I'll tell you an interesting factoid. This is the second Will Smith appearance in a musical. In the same month, he's also appearing in a Bollywood film where he's dancing for a minute in an actual dance number, and he's way more energetic in that 1 minute than he is in an entire Genie performance in Aladdin.
I was thinking
all this time, why didn't they go all out Bollywood musical? Because they're clearly going for that sense of wonder and music and fantasy and realism, and yet they're not.
They almost did. And
almost did.
The thing with Agrabah, which has a very nondescript coastline,
yes.
Agrabah doesn't exist. So they bring in elements of Persian, of Arabic, of South Asian culture, and they could have gone full pelt with this. There's a great bit where there's a both Middle Eastern and specifically Bollywood-inspired dance number, and I really like the scene we refer to, which is original to the film, but they never really pursue that throughout the rest of it. It's a very, for lack of a better term, Western staged musical, and you had so much opportunity to branch out here.
I mean, people roll their eyes at Bollywood musicals and say they're melodramatic and
they're great.
But the thing is, it's very hard to do, to actually commit to the sense of fantasy. And I think Hollywood has kind of forgotten that, especially Guy Ritchie has definitely forgotten that. And
he was
married to Madonna at one point, which is still the most weird factoid that I can think of, and he still doesn't know how to make a good musical.
That's Madonna lately. Did you see a Eurovision performance?
That's right. Yeah, but I guess, you know, there's falls from grace and then there's falls from Agrabah. So, you know, you can only survive one. But it's really sad. But the one thing that I do kind of feel for is that the performances weren't that bad. Naomi Scott is decent.
She was good.
A lot of the peak characters, what's the main guy's name? Like
Mina Masoodi is a Canadian actor.
He was charming.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing.
Without being great, Will Smith was goddamn charming.
Yeah. Will Smith was charming. Will Smith was your best mate, a super cool guy who you go out to a party with and go out to the club with and have a great time.
The worst part about this film.
Yeah, Chris is smiling because he knows exactly what I'm talking about.
the worst thing about this film is the Aladdin hangover, the franchise that it's carrying. Actually, if the actors were left to their own devices, they actually have the charm to, you know, tell you a story and be in a movie which, if devoid of any Aladdin hangover, could have been actually a fun film. Like, I would be willing to go on an adventure with these people to a different land which had nothing to do with Aladdin.
I think Mina Masood was good about half the time. I would like to see him more in stuff outside this universe, which is why, again, taking your point, alluding to the TV series, which was I really enjoyed, when they just let it free and let it go and they could do whatever they want and explore these exotic locales. There's a couple of moments like that in this movie. I think he can carry some of the lighter sequences. I don't think he can carry dramatic sequences at all. Naomi Scott certainly could. I also think a lot of the chemistry and appeal for their dynamic fell on her rather than him. And she's a much stronger performer than he was. I don't think he was spectacularly well cast.
God, yeah, he was kind of a wooden face when it comes to emotional emoting of any kind of seriousness, yeah.
The as you say, the cast are really charming, with the exception of Jafar.
Yeah, Marwan Kenzari, terrible, terrible casting. Jafar's one of the coolest characters. Like, who wouldn't want to play Jafar? And you needed someone who could chew the scenery like Alan Rickman as the Sheriff of Nottingham. He was bad.
They decided to play him as, I guess, a realistic Jafar, which is bizarre in a film that is in no way realistic.
Exactly.
Actually, on the subject of the realism, or lack thereof, what was with the handling of the animals? That was odd.
All right. Iago and Abu were really badly done. They just looked like actual animals without much real expression. The carpet was really bad too. I felt it was just a carbon copy of the cloak in Doctor Strange, which again was actually was riffing off Aladdin, the carpet in Aladdin originally.
Well, there's all these CG characters hanging around who are just there. I think it feels like they're there because people might have, you know, complained if they weren't, and that's it.
I'm going to draw a distinction though with Raja. He was really good. And I think
was
that's the picture of the tiger. Yeah,
it was just a tiger.
He had personality.
I think tigers are just charming because they're tigers. I don't think they had to do much, to be honest. They're Bengal tigers. I mean, they're just, you know, a charming beast.
I think that the template of the original film makes this hard to completely screw up. They've stayed very, very close. And as we were saying, like, the cast have a likability to them. And it's fast-paced. It is eye-popping. There's a likability to this film.
The other cast member.
There shouldn't be, but there is.
Yeah, the other cast member who we haven't mentioned, who I think is actually probably the best in this film, in the short role he had, was Billy Magnussen as what was either a German or Scandinavian prince. If you remember the scene in the original where the prince was courting Jasmine and Raj bit him and he had like heart-shaped underwear. It's about as close as you can get to real...
Raja, I think. Raj. I forget. You said Raj, as in the Big Bang Theory, Raj.
Was it Raja or Raja?
I think the cat's Raja.
Raja, okay, Raja. Yeah. And there
yes.
You watched the Big Bang Theory, Raj?
No, it's all right.
Oh, my God.
The show is terrible. Only two Indian people are probably listening to the show. I'm sorry, all Indian people are not called Raj. We apologize.
I wasn't
things were escalated
that.
To a yeah, boiling point I know of that tension Bharat, here I, in I the have, CR studios.
I have other Indian friends, thank you. Raj, some aren't. So,
yeah. Oh, yeah, actually.
We're into the Indian friends excuse now. Things aren't looking good for Glenn.
Hello, Akshay. I know you don't listen to the show, but you should.
Wow. Okay, so yes, the tiger, I've just googled it now, is called Raja. I don't see how they got racialized, but there you go. And we went to, so what were we doing? Billy Magnussen. Yeah, he's really good.
He was funny.
You know what's good about him? He was cartoonish.
Yes.
He was cartoonish in a way that none of the other performers were. The Sultan wasn't cartoonish. Jasmine and Aladdin certainly weren't. Will Smith was to a little extent, but it was really just charming Will Smith Fresh Prince of Bel-Air-ish rather than cartoonish fun.
Actually that's a good point you make. I think Billy Magnussen, let me get my tongue straight.
Yeah, because if you don't, that's culturally insensitive, Virat.
Yeah, he seems to be the only one who's got the brief where he knows the tone that he's pitching at. I think every other actor is trying to either be like, I don't know exactly what kind of gallery I'm playing to. I think that's basically the problem of the movie. They don't know which universe they belong in. And that is the problem of this film. It's a charming film, but it doesn't know why it exists, which is fair. I don't know why it exists beyond the point that it's making a lot of money.
That's the reason. There's not enough that is new to recommend this film beyond the original. Like, who wouldn't rather... He had a choice between watching one or the other. I'll probably watch the cartoon again one day. Are we ever going to watch this again? Does this have any staying power?
Will this replace the cartoon for anyone?
No, I don't think
so. No, never. No. Never. Not even close.
And I think you can say that for any of the Disney movies. I haven't seen Dumbo, granted.
Hmm.
But like, just,
I did actually enjoy Maleficent more than Sleeping Beauty, to be fair.
I mean, just right now, we all listen to the theme song again.
Nostalgic for the original film, not for the
exactly.
new one.
You know, but also in those 3 minutes, we had more fun than I had watching the entire new movie at any point.
Except for the DJ Khaled bit at the end.
Okay, fine. Okay, you know, so we need more DJ Khaled, but
another one.
But yeah, and that's sad. That is, if that is supposedly to appeal to a new generation of people who are going to be, you know, oh my God, it's Aladdin. But no, guys, it's, you know, there's something that was captured in that moment of time that was precious and that was fun, which still is like a time capsule. Like, it's not gone away. Like, you can still listen to that. You can still enjoy it. And the fun comes back. You don't need to recreate it. You don't need to repackage it. You don't need to resell it. It's there already to exist for eternity. And I wish studios just understood that and just kept it in their pants.
So
that's a strange...
Speaking of pants, where were Aladdin's pants? Like the white puffy ones?
Yeah, why were there no Harem pants in this?
Yeah, and the purple like vest?
Yeah.
There was none of that.
He looked kind of like a lobby boy.
Yeah. At least I got the curly toed shoes right.
Not because... I was trying to preempt the joke that I saw coming, but then I realized I'd be digging a hole for myself. So I'm going to change the subject to something else. Like,
I mean, Glenn and I both have dug holes for ourselves, but so you might as well go for it, Chris.
Oh God.
Oh well. So yeah, the costuming. You know, I'll give it
the costume. We're having more fun discussing this movie than I actually had watching this movie.
The monkey sucked. Abu?
Abu.
Yeah, he. What was the point of him?
Oh no, he was boring.
You said yesterday to me, like, did you find him a little bit creepy?
Yeah, he was a creepy monkey. It was just a creepy, weird monkey.
He looked like the monkey from Jeffrey Rush, the Jack Sparrow, the Pirates of the Caribbean. He looked a lot like that, and
Jeffrey Rush.
I know what monkey you're referring to. Yeah.
Rush. And that monkey is Jeffrey Rush.
Captain Barbosa has a monkey on his shoulder in. Yeah. So a generic
also,
monkey. Okay. So what else about this film? Some of the costuming was good. Princess Jasmine, she looked the part.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jafar was quite well dressed. I will give it to them. Like, he looked the part, but he didn't.
He had, there was nothing scary about him.
No. And his voice. His voice was so.
He has this kind of thin, high-pitched voice.
Yeah, it is like.
Yeah, it's a very strange choice.
Yeah, it was like as if, you know, he's somewhat intimidating, but then voiced by John Cryer, you know? And I was just like, you know. You know.
What was Gilbert Gottfried? Actually, Iago didn't have a voice. Not really. It was just Iago just repeated
stuff. He did say things that were beyond repeating phrases at times.
Yeah.
He was this kind of straight. They went partway into Iago as a person that can talk. Yeah. And partway to he's just a parrot that repeats things.
So it is either that or just Matthew Broderick from whatever.
Matthew Broderick.
Did he play Aladdin?
No, he played Simba in The Lion King.
Yeah.
Right.
Aladdin
was played by some dude.
Aladdin was played by, like, this was actually a lot of the cast performers were professional voice actors rather than professional like A-listers, which is just fine.
Which is how it probably was before Robin Williams being cast as Genie.
That started
and a lot of the time. I'm not sure that started it, but I think the trend of A-list actors being cast in animated films was not.
Yeah,
Big. I guess until the golden age of Disney animation.
That is correct. Mm. Yeah, as it was in the YouTube video. Which
I haven't watched that yet.
Yeah,
but
discussing that. But you're right, and that's also with Bat. The other show which Robin Williams wanted to do with Disney, which Disney kind of wanted to cull because
I'm not sure.
Anyway,
so
what are we sure about when you're talking about things? Anyway, so yeah.
Yes, we do.
It's Aladdin.
So that is Aladdin. So that is Aladdin, not featuring Ron Williams.
And Aladdin gets confused about what he's talking about.
Not featuring Jafar as a giant snake. That is in cinemas now.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, there was no giant snake.
Oh, my God, yes. Yeah. Wait, that was...
It's very disappointing. I was holding out for that.
Best part of my childhood.
Whoa.
Wow. I was more of a Lion King fan, but...
No, yeah, Lion King. Lion King is just a glorified Hamlet. Yeah.
Beautiful.
I'd rather read Shakespeare. Okay.
You read Shakespeare when you were 5 years old?
Yeah, the Charlton Mary Lamb version.
I believe you. I believe you, Virat. I believe you. So that is Aladdin.
Sorry, I've revealed some very sad truths about my life today.
It is in cinemas now. Sydney Film Festival kicks off next Wednesday, the 5th of June. In the last few minutes, we were going to return to Rocket Man to talk about a more serious aspect of it. Just to recap the movie, yeah, look, I take the view, as an Elton John fan, I think it is something that casual to dedicate Elton John fans will enjoy. If you're not one of those, I don't think while there are some elements of the craft and storytelling that are interesting, I don't think there's enough in it to recommend it in and of itself. I always like films to be appealing regardless of your empathy or interest in the subject matter, and that should expose you to a new subject area. I would love to see a film about an artist that I'm not too interested in and which gets me interested in their story by virtue of how original and creative the storytelling is. But speaking of Rocket Man, we want to talk about, I think, the film's greatest attraction. Before we do that, we're going to give a content warning. We're going to be talking about quite a serious issue, which we discussed in quite some detail, which was occurring throughout the Sydney Film Festival program last year in terms of the films that played, which is the issue of suicide. And we'll be providing the number to Lifeline later in the program. When we recapped the Sydney Film Festival last year, we saw roughly in the order of 110 films. I think about a third of those we counted had prominently within them the issue of suicide, and that was either depicting suicide or alluding to it or discussing it or having it featured prominently as a theme.
Yeah.
This in Rock.
So far, suicide hasn't appeared in any of the films I've watched from the festival prior to the festival. So.
Neither. No.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah.
Yes. It's change of pace.
It is a relief. It's yeah.
Rocket Man. We spoke towards the end of the review at the beginning of the show about a scene where the most widely publicized scene in the film, and it features him in a swimming pool. The way the scene plays out is that he walks up to the swimming pool, announces and alludes to in no small way that he intends to commit suicide, falls into the pool, and then begins to sing Rocket Man with a version of his childhood self underwater. Now, there were many more appropriate songs that could have played at this time. Someone Saved My Life Tonight, they chose Rocket Man for this instance. From the underwater scene, they progress to a bit where he's on a stage and he's continuing Rocket Man, and quite literally, and unlike what is actually anything in the song, he takes off like a rocket in flight, and in the next scene he's on a plane being served by women in short skirts and everything seems okay. Now, aside from the fact, putting aside the more serious consequential aspects of it, the scene itself is garish, it is unnecessary, and it's completely totally distinct from everything else in the film. Now to the more consequential aspects of it. We spoke in the context of the Sydney Film Festival last year, and it's not just in the context of the films that played there, but many films that play throughout the year, how the issue of suicide or the act of suicide is used as an aside or a passing note or as a plot device. It's frustrating. I thought and hoped we would have moved on to an extent from that, certainly in films that many thousands and millions of people are going to see. We certainly haven't. It deals with the issue very... very quickly. It passes it by. It doesn't. It shows it as a big dramatic event in his life, but doesn't reckon with the consequence or significance of this. Now, this is evident for a lot of the film. I alluded earlier to how his first marriage, is shown in just a couple of scenes. Really big aspects of his life are run through very quickly. Now, if you, as a general criticism of filmmaking, you should take the time to tell aspects of a story, otherwise make a 4 or 5 hour movie or miniseries. But if you're going to include an aspect as important as this, certainly I didn't feel they wanted to pass over it, you have to reckon with it and you have to follow through and you have to show the aftermath of the consequences. Certainly a lot of the film does take place in five flashbacks where he is in rehab and trying to acclimatize back to regular life and take stock. but there's no immediate follow through for this hugely emotional and very consequential event. And in a film which has a lot of hits and has a lot of misses, I found this very strange. I found this very disappointing. And I think it's really a lousy thing for films to do. I think it's something that I think we need to move on from in cinema. And I think it's something that Rocketman, as what will be a very prominent film for years to come, sets a very bad example for.
It sort of reminded me of this very big problem that I have with mainstream cinema at this point, especially Hollywood films, is how or can they actually reckon with serious topics, and if they want to, how do they do it? And is everything played up for a gag or a joke, or everything needs to be undercut with some kind of humor, which kind of sidelined some very important and serious discussions which need to have? And if you include it, either I'll be okay with the fact that you don't allude to that at all, you completely omit that because that's not the kind of story you're telling. But if you want to tell that story, I feel it's important to do it justice in a way that you give the subject the sensitivity that it deserves. And I feel that's where a lot of the films in the mainstream space are falling short, because they have to appeal to the broadest kind of audience and they have to put bumps on seats. It's a sad juxtaposition, unfortunately.
I think it's pretty, alluding to one of the points you made, it's pretty emblematic of this film and also to an extent Bohemian Rhapsody, where I feel the filmmakers felt they had to tick off so many boxes. This was a well-known and quite a confronting chapter in Elton's life. Certainly, he's been more vocal about it in recent years. I would have been perfectly fine with foregoing large aspects of, like, even confining the film to a couple of years if it meant telling a more complete story. But if you're going to tell things like, you're going to cover aspects like this, you have to cover them well, you have to do it properly, and you can't just cut corners. And they did. And the film goes at such a breakneck pace. It is it's not great from a storytelling perspective. It's less forgivable when you're dealing with matters as serious as this.
The other kind of big problem that I have with it is the fact that you're not allowing your audience to feel anything serious. Like, you know, right now, if you're going for a mainstream movie, you're going in with the primary intention of being entertained. And, you know, you have to feel light, you have to feel fuzzy and warm. And any kind of serious or melancholic emotion is almost brushed away or under the carpet, which is kind of, I don't know if that's something I kind of can digest.
So that is our discussion, a renewed discussion about Rocketman. I feel that even though we have discussed the greatest attraction of the film, it is still a film worth seeing. It's something, obviously, people have to take stock of if they do see the movie, but there are many aspects to it which are incredibly creative. I certainly take the view that as a big Elton John fan, if you don't know his music too well and you're interested in, you know, a few of the songs, if you saw The Lion King and are anticipating the new remake, maybe see this because you'll be exposed to a lot more of his songs, many of his great songs. And then if you like the artist, just the same as I would say with Queen and Bohemian Rhapsody, go pick up an album. And that number for Lifeline, if you are having difficulties, you are feeling issues, or there's someone you want to talk about anything to, we encourage you to very, very much do so. The number for Lifeline is 131114. That's 131114. If you feel the need to do so, please do give them a call. So that is film Fight Club. That is Rocketman is in cinemas tomorrow. Aladdin is out now. The Sydney Film Festival, political documentaries and everything else is screening from the 5th to the 16th of June around Sydney.
Well, around Sydney, and Sydney is the centre of the universe. So, you know, this is the place to be.
In the world.
In the world.
The Sydney Film Festival will be playing.
Oh, we forgot Moore Park. We forgot Moore Park. Hoyts. We said Ritz. Yeah. We said Orpheum.
Entertainment Quarter, as we said. Entertainment is there.
And the State Library.
And, oh yes, the State Library. Yeah. And the Art Gallery of New South Wales, actually.
Sorry, not the State Library, the Art Gallery of New South Wales, I meant to say. Different places. Very close, but different places.
Yeah, but, you know, art is there.
Art is there. Have a wonderful night.
Art lives!
good morning, Agrabah. It's probably morning there right now. And good night.
Good
Everyone
night,
else.
Vietnam!